today on Against the Grain.
If you're wealthy, you know, you don't fly first class, you have a private jet. And you don't go to like the nice part of the hospital, there's private wings of special hospitals if you're wealthy to get away from everybody. And the great thing about markets is you can achieve this just naturally by charging more. You don't have to say, this space is only for the wealthy, no poor. You just put a giant price on the one drinking fountain, and what do you know? It's naturally segregated.
Extreme inequality defines our age. The world's wealthiest 0.001%, a mere 60,000 people, own three times more wealth than half of the world's population combined. And such inequality is increasing with time. Economist Rob Larson discusses the cloistered world of the very rich, their power and wealth, and their influence over all our lives. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The riches of the multimillionaire and billionaire class have become so stratospheric that it's hard for most of us to fathom. And while supporting and enriching the wealthy has been a bipartisan affair, boosted by both Democrats and Republicans, the fortunes of the very rich have grown especially under Trump. Rob Larson is professor of economics and the author of Mastering the Universe, The Obscene Wealth of the Ruling Class, What They Do with Their Money, and Why You Should Hate Them Even More. When I spoke with Rob Larson, I asked him how the 1% have benefited from the Trump administration.
For all of Trump's norm-shattering and crazy idiosyncrasies, economically, he broadly governs as a Republican. That has historically been the case. So in the first Trump term in 2017, we had a fairly large corporate tax cut, lowering the tax on corporate profits, including overseas repatriated earnings. As we've discussed on this program before, the large majority of stock that represents the ownership of these big global corporate firms belongs to the richer echelon of households, very large concentration, particularly in the 1% and in smaller subsections of that wealth echelon of households. So that definitely greatly benefited them. And this past spring's so-called Big Beautiful Bill had a number of further tax provisions that further benefit them. So absolutely, the wealthy class is benefiting heavily from Trump. And, you know, it's not too shocking. I mean, billionaires, most prominently Elon Musk, but most of the other right-wing plutocratic usual suspects poured money into Trump's 2024 campaign, anticipating that they would get major economic rewards, which have flowed. As this administration has been more erratic than the first one, things have happened that the wealthy, I mean, and the Republican mainstream aren't as crazy about. The big ones would be the renewed trade war, of course, as well as the attacks on the independence of the Federal Reserve, which I think could end up casting a much longer shadow over America's future than any one tax reform, you know. But absolutely major, major dividends to the rich over their investments in the Trump campaign.
The issue of affordability has become a very prominent one. And of course, it predates Trump, in fact. Much of his success in his second term, or getting there anyway, owes to the issue of affordability being a large one in the U.S. society under Biden. When you think about these questions of affordability, well, number one, how do you see it as a kind of framing term to encompass a lot of the class inequality that is baked into our society? I mean, it's certainly been something that has driven campaigns on the left. But I wanted to ask you more broadly, as someone who's thought a lot about the class system in the United States, what you think of a politics, whether it's on the left or in the center or on the right, framed around affordability?
That's a great question. I definitely think that there's a lot of potency in that. I think, you know, from the point of view of today's economy, I don't think it's too shocking that candidates, most prominently New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani, has been able to see success with a campaign around that concept. Any economist will tell you we have a cost of living crisis in this country, pretty much wall to wall. People focus on inflation pushing up the price of groceries, and that's fine. Landlords are completely out of control in this country. They're using real-time software with actual lease data to effectively collude on raising rents, which is brutalizing people. And you have student loan payments that are now, you know, out of their COVID forbearance era. And in every area where people have to pay for food, for rent, for debt, those costs are increasing at a time where, of course, real wages have been stagnating since the 70s. They did, of course, have a significant increase in 2020 and 2021, associated, of course, with the pandemic. People kind of forget this, but historically, major diseases tend to take a significant part of the labor force out of the picture, which tends to increase pay that has to be offered for workers who remain in the market. That is being undone as firms are going through waves of layoffs and replacing roles with the very weak AI functions that we have so far. But the cost of living thing is very real, and the affordability speaks to that. Now, the latter part of that question is about how the rich connect to this. I think inequality is hugely aggravating this question of affordability, and I would say it does it from two directions. Most obviously, as we said, with stagnating wages for the last 50 years, the economy has grown most years. Productivity, which drives economic growth, has grown most years. Pay has stagnated. So just not giving the working class or the professional class even their share of the economic growth makes it harder for them to keep up with costs, obviously. But further, we should realize these days, people sometimes like to use the phrase an everything bubble, that we have a bubble, which is, you know, an unsustainable increase in some asset prices, like we saw in the 2008 housing crisis, for example. People are saying that we're seeing that sort of price spike across so many sectors of the market, certainly including the stock market, where equity prices are wildly high, but clearly also in housing and in all kinds of assets, all the way up to and including ludicrous non-assets like cryptocurrency. So that is significantly a reflection of the growth of wealth inequality. I always explain this to my students. Middle-class people and working-class people treat new income differently from how the rich treat it. If you're a working-class or middle-class person and your income increases because you got a raise at work or maybe a tax reduction, you spend most of that money. You know, you spend it on Junior's braces, and I need to pay off this credit card. I've been putting off this health procedure I need that costs an astronomical amount. Maybe I want to take a middle-class vacation and take the kids to Disney World. Normal people spend their income on their quality of life. Wealthy people, if you're in anything approaching the 1% or even more rarefied heights, you already have, broadly speaking, the standard of living that you want. You own multiple houses outright. My God, just imagine that. An amazing thing to imagine. You own multiple cars. You have places in different parts of the country or the world, so you can be there in the seasons that you like. You have money in the bank. So when you get new income from Trump cutting your taxes, you invest that money. That money goes into all kinds of financial instruments via your Wall Street consultants. And that may mean buying exchange-traded funds that hold housing equity. Or it may mean especially putting it into the stock market, you know, the equity market. So much money being concentrated in the rich means they pour their huge bloated wealth into these markets and skyrocket their asset prices. So I would make the case that affordability is hugely aggravated by our growth in wealth and income inequality, both because on the lower ends, it means your pay isn't keeping up with expenses, let alone your own working productivity. And the money that you should be getting is going to wealthy households who pour it into markets that drive up the cost of assets from housing to stocks to anything else you might need to buy. So affordability, I think, is a perfectly viable one word conversation opener politically to get toward the issue of the ruling class and wealth inequality, because it is hugely aggravated by that question.
And yet, in contrast to what you've just been describing, there are those who, at least a few years ago, were blaming affordability issues and inflation specifically on people getting government subsidies during COVID, or even that moment that you were describing when people for a short while had higher wages.
It's true. And it's amazing to see what established opinion will chalk up as a cause of inflation and what they won't. So absolutely, during COVID, you have a national emergency, people are dying, thousands of people are leaving the workforce to care for the elderly or people who have, you know, immune conditions or any other kind of increased vulnerability to that respiratory disease, which we should remember killed a million Americans above our normal expectancy for death over those years. Just a staggering, brutal tragedy that the world underwent, and certainly including the U.S., for unavoidable reasons and for very avoidable reasons. So you have that event. It's very reasonable to have a subsidy program or to have a program of public income supports, which is broadly what we did by encouraging firms to keep people who they weren't actively giving hours to on the payroll and forgiving those loans later through the PPP program that people may recall from just 5 years ago, yet seems so long ago. So that's a cause of inflation if you're a conservative. We've handed out all this money. Reckless Trump and Biden handing out cash, shout irresponsible. On the other hand, we've been cutting taxes on the rich who do nothing with that money but pour it into financial markets that inflate the price of housing, that inflate the price of equity, and create asset bubbles and all these other problems, and absolutely do contribute to inflation. It's an amazing thing to see what counts as a contributor to inflation and what does not. You know, it's always a highly political subject, despite our economic technocratic affectations.
How have income and wealth tracked in the U.S. over the 20th century and into the 21st? So as we're thinking about the trajectory of the very rich, how can we understand it over that longer period of time?
The big interruption in the broad trend of the wealthiest 10% owning about half of the national income and the wealthiest 1% getting about a third. The big interruption in this trend of wealth concentration was the advent of the New Deal period in the middle part of the 20th century, you know, the 1900s, as my students sometimes say. There, because of the Herculean, godlike toil of the labor movement in the 1920s and 30s and the CIO in building up demands for taxation on the wealthy, and of course the advent of the Great Depression and the Roosevelt administration, which sort of forced the hand of the government to begin doing this, you start taxing the rich aggressively and their share of wealth falls significantly. So that wealthiest 10% of households, their percentage share of the national income goes from almost half in 1929, at the peak of the Great Depression, down to just a third, about 33% or so, fluctuating around that point, for the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, what we now consider to be the New Deal era, or Great Society era in the United States. And that is where we got all the money to not constantly run government budget deficits. Budget deficits are supposed to be for recessions and emergencies like wars. We just run giant budget deficits now, Democratic and Republican administrations, growth years and recession years. We didn't used to do that because we taxed the rich. And that's when we built the Golden Gate Bridge and the interstate highway system, put people on the moon. How do we pay for all that? We paid for it by taxing the rich at aggressive levels. You know, we had very high capital gains taxes. The marginal tax rate for income topped out in the 90s of percents, very high levels. Starting in the 80s and then proceeding on since then, the cornerstone of economic policy has been tax cuts across the board, but of course, primarily cutting taxes on the wealthy, who are the most politically powerful constituency and where there is more cutting to be done. And so with the Reagan administration's large tax cuts, George W. Bush administration, of course, did two of those, one in each of his administrations, one in the first Trump administration, another one in the current administration. With those, the wealthiest households have largely returned to their proportion of the national wealth that they had during the Gilded Age before this all began. So we're largely seeing a return to where we were around a century ago when the CIO was doing so much work to build up a movement to constrain the power of the wealthy. And I will say, I think it does show the limits of reformism, frankly. I mean, at the height of the New Deal, it really looked like the rich had been tamed. You know, these huge tax rates. Again, the wealthiest 10% of households never had less than a third of the national income. So they never were anywhere near getting poor. but they were significantly constrained. You didn't have the clear sense that they were driving policy. Individual, what very rich people couldn't just steer elections as people like Elon Musk are now absolutely able to do. But that is largely gone now because during the New Deal period I'm describing, where the wealthy's proportion of the national income and wealth decreased quite significantly. All through the New Deal, though, the wealthy got to keep their private property. We never did nationalization. We never socialized large sectors of the economy. And the whole idea was, you know, we're clever Anglo-Americans. We don't want to go as far as those crazy continental Europeans, let alone people in other parts of the world, who are nationalizing major forms of wealth, even forms of wealth that usually eventuate in monopoly, like transportation or energy, or even healthcare in our country, unique in our case. And what that meant was that the wealthy were able to keep their main source of social power, which is their ownership of the productive wealth in the country, the capital, you know, the great agricultural estates and the huge manufacturing centers and the oil refineries and today's data centers. Those things remained private property. And once we got to a point in the 70s, where for all kinds of geopolitical reasons, we had very high inflation and high unemployment. They were able to bring in a very conservative administration, the Reagan administration, because they retained the wealthy and the corporations that they own. They retained their position of social power. They were able to get the Reagan administration in and get the tax burden and regulatory burden lifted. That had been very serious for some time during that New Deal, Great Society era. They were able to get rid of that. And so they were able to reassert their social power and put us basically back in the box that we were in a century ago, just with much fancier technology and a much more drastic environmental situation. It's a trajectory that is rough to look at, but does teach the lesson that if you tax these guys but let them keep their private property, not your personal property like your house and your clothes, but your productive property that makes the economic output of society, they are still ultimately in the driver's seat of the country and can reassert themselves when they have an advantageous moment, as came in the 70s.
A key point for activists to mull. But in contrast to the story that you've just told about the rich striking back, but a different story is often told, which is that the wealthy are rich because of the tremendous innovation of the last few decades, the companies they're connected to, or the people themselves, that they have come up with these great technological innovations and been rewarded handsomely. What do you make of that argument?
That is often something that is referred to when people want to defend the incredible wealth of the higher end households, absolutely. And I have a section on this in Mastering the Universe and a whole chapter on it in BitTyrants, my book on big tech, which folks can refer to. The short version is, I mean, it's a ludicrous claim. Most of today's fancy online technologies completely rely on the public internet, which was, of course, developed by the Department of Defense's research arm, DARPA, and a couple of the larger research universities like MIT, Stanford, and some others in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And by the 1990s, we had so much work done on this that you could have different forms of telecommunications interact with each other and communicate fairly seamlessly. And this was the advent of the internetwork, or the internet as we call it today. All these guys from Jeff Bezos to the Google founders got wealthy by developing useful technology that completely depends on this publicly developed telecommunications infrastructure and all the very important and complex technical standards, which had to be developed by the public sector so that all these systems could speak to each other. Without that, every individual operator had their own system and insisted that it should be the standard. Only the state-aligned institutions had the weight to force a single standard on everyone and allow them to develop the internet that then Amazon can be built on and Google can be built on, and AI centers can distribute their products through. All of this new economy stuff up through today's AI bubble completely depend on that technology. And this is often true for other products like pharmaceuticals and medical devices and so on. Basic research is expensive. and there's zero guarantee it will get you anything. People have such a funny TV-based idea of how invention and innovation work, and they think you can have a funny Rick and Morty TV scientist character, and every episode or movie, they invent an amazing new technology in their garage in a lab they run for free somehow, even though custom equipment is incredibly expensive and usually involved in this kind of stuff. And we have the idea that's just something that's created, and any billionaire is the one who developed the technology. Almost without exception, these guys are, you know, today's CEOs are riding on technology someone else developed, usually using that public infrastructure there. And indeed, the tendency is for these firms, once they get big corporate empires and monopolistic or oligopolistic positions, their tendency, of course, is to be arch-conservative in the sense of both being politically conservative because they don't want to pay taxes on their earnings, but also conservative that they don't want changes to their industry because it could disrupt the large profitable position that they're in. I think it's very telling, and I talk about this in BitTyrants, and most histories of the internet discuss it. During the development of the early internet, including when it was called DARPANET originally, because it was just an arm of the Pentagon for a while, a couple times the scientists and military tried to privatize the early technology, and technology companies declined to buy it. So at one point they tried to get AT&T, you know, the big phone monopolist of, you know, the 20th century, to buy the early internet technology, and they didn't want to do it because they were afraid it would disrupt their existing legacy phone voice phone line business. An amazing view, of course, in retrospect. And a couple other firms declined to buy it, if I recall. I think IBM was another one. That's from memory. People can look in the books. But they tried a number of times to privatize it. And even Bill Gates in the early 90s was declining to go to conferences on the early internet because it's all free and it's all junk. How am I going to make money from that? I have a monopolistic operating system. I'm worried about this internet disrupting my global computing monopoly. So really, the role of these guys in innovation is the opposite of what they claim it is. And I would just add one final thing. Just because I've been thinking about this lately, so much of what we call innovation at the consumer product level is just wastefulness. So sweeping and mopping your floors, a unpleasant, taxing, time-consuming chore. Many people listening will know you can buy fun consumer products that will make that chore slightly easier. For example, you can buy the Swiffer, I think it's called. The Swiffer is a little product you can get, and it's like a mop, but at the end, you know, when you have a mop, you mop your floor and it gets the dirt off the floor and that's nice. Your floor is clean. It looks nice in there. That's good. But then you have to like wash out your cloth mop, you know, the yarn or cloth material, which is now full of dirty water and it's disgusting. With the Swiffer, you have a disposable little moist brush on there and you just push a button and it drops into the trash. So much easier. And it's just a waste creating thing though. Now we're throwing something out into the trash made of plastics that will end up in our bodies and in the environment forever so that I don't have to wring out a mop every week. Yay! It's amazing to see the construct that innovation is, you know. And now, of course, innovation means AI, which everyone agrees is, which many people will frankly say is going to make people untrustable over long distances. It's going to maybe destroy the internet by creating very powerful hacking bots that humans can't match. Allow me to say, AI, it's siphoning up every water table, sucking up every penny that we should be using for the energy transition. We're going to regret this in a few years. But what it does do is make it completely frigging impossible to evaluate student work, because they use it so freely, and they're constantly encouraged to use it even to write, you know, condolence cards to their relatives when someone dies, let alone writing a short essay on a final exam assigned by an innocent professor such as myself. I was grading final exams, and I had student essays that in the essay field, the students had accidentally included the prompts that they used for the AI LLM to write their answers. I'm not kidding. I can show you this. It is a hell of a thing. So innovation, what a twisted social construct we have made of that.
Terrible. Well, technology aside, the idea of innovation aside, there are many people, many working class people, middle class people, who think that the class structure in the U.S. is fair. That the people who are on the top because they have earned it in some way. And I want to ask you, when we look at the rich in the U.S., I mean, putting aside all these questions about how they earned it and on whose backs and all that stuff, but if we're to look at the wealthy in the U.S., do we have any sense of how many of those people inherited their wealth?
Oh, sure. And this is something that is discussed somewhat regularly. Studies of wealth are often trying to get at this. And I will say it's not always an incredibly simple question, because not infrequently you'll have people who started out with significant money that they inherited, you know, or were gifted from their families, and then use that to build up some business destroying the environment that also makes their own money. So saying like one person inherited their money and another one is self-made, those are very common usages, and that's fine. We should realize it's very, very common for these guys to start with significant money and turn it into giant money, you know? So like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, developed Facebook seconds before Harvard University itself was going to develop its own version back in the early 2000s. You know, came from a wealthy professional family, went to a private high school, you know. Jeff Bezos starts Amazon with a large six-figure loan from his parents. So not coming from poverty, not also global ruling class either. But would they have been able to enter that global ruling class stratosphere if it weren't for the privilege that they inherited from their merely professional or merely wealthy parents? It's a debatable question, you know? And then you have figures, of course, like, you know, Donald Trump or the Koch kids, who were born rich and remain rich. So it's not always a super clear distinction, just to make that point. If you read conservative coverage of this subject, anyone who ever had a business is self-made, even if they started out with this large endowment that they got from the foundation of mom and dad. So there is a variety, of course. And we should mention too, like, inheritance plays a giant role in all this. There is no crusade for the right that is more important to them than ending the death tax, as they call it, which of course means the estate tax. And it's, of course, an outrageous usage. The estate tax is charged on families that are passing on millions of dollars. Like, most of us will never encounter the estate tax when our family members die, because our families don't own that kind of wealth. I'm talking about many millions of dollars here to qualify for, you know, being subject to the estate tax. Whereas everyone dies. If it was actually a tax on death, everyone would pay it. But of course, only the wealthy pay it. You call it the death tax, so it just sounds like an outrageous government intrusion instead of a legitimate way of taking a share of unearned wealth, by definition, you inherit, and using it for public purposes that we drastically need money for.
And yet, of course, that term death tax is very effective, right? Because there are many working class and middle class people who think that it's actually coming for them.
Absolutely. And that's the beauty of a term like death tax. Like, I know that I will die eventually because I'm a mortal human being, and therefore I will pay the death tax. You will not be paying the death tax, most of you who are listening to this, or your descendants or surviving spouse will not. It's for large estates. That's why we call it the estate tax, even though idiots like to call it the death tax. These things are very effective at terrorizing people who are not super engaged in this kind of, in politics and being aware of what's going on. I hate to say it, but in America, politics is niche, man. People are hustling all the time to work for a living. When they're not, it's a incredibly entertainment and media saturated society, infinite stuff to stream, hugely engrossing video games. It's not so easy to get people to step away from that stuff and focus on, well, here's the actual wealth threshold for the estate tax. It's just not easy to get people to focus on that, even in a classroom environment, I can tell you. So you're absolutely right. It is all too effective, and there's a reason why conservatives like to use it. But the point is, when you have so much publicly developed technology and it's possible to build a huge monopolistic firm on the back of it, many, like a significant proportion of today's very, very richest people did co-found a firm that has some useful technology, an operating system, a search engine, you know, a commerce platform, form, whatever it might be. But often they're starting with at least a significant, if not a lot of money from their family. So it's kind of a blurred line in many cases. But we can say this for sure, with the estate tax having been reduced by a number of these Republican tax bills, the amount being inherited by their awful offspring will be significantly larger than it was in the past. I mean, the Trump kids will inherit a lot when Trump dies one day. If you look at people like the richest man in Europe, Bernard Arnault, you know, the head of the LVMH luxury goods conglomerate, for a period of time, 2 years ago, he was the richest person in the world when his firm's stock was at a high point. He grooms each of his kids to run a large arm of his huge conglomerate. So in a way, he put that conglomerate together mostly by buying other companies that cater to very, very wealthy people. But then you put your children into running a piece of it. So are they inheritors? Sure, but they're also running a business. So blurring those lines partially purposefully is something that I think the rich have caught on to.
I'm speaking with Rob Larson, economist, author of Mastering the Universe, The Obscene Wealth of the Ruling Class, What They Do With Their Money, and Why You Should Hate Them Even More. Well, one of the things that can provoke, I think, a lot of ire when we hear the details, but for other people, envy, is the lifestyles of the wealthy. Now, some people, I think, follow this stuff obsessively, but for most of us, it is kind of out of sight, out of mind. Like, it's so different than our lives that a world of super yachts and multiple mansions and expensive artwork and travel and private planes, you know, it's just hard to conceive of. Can you just tell us briefly what the wealthy are partially doing with their money?
Yeah, sure. And it is a whole other world. And actually, part of that is on purpose, of course. Something I discuss a lot in the book is one of the things the wealthy most invest in is exclusiveness. There is no word that is more commonly used when marketing to high-end consumers than the word exclusive. Exclusive venue, exclusive living area, exclusive experience, exclusive travel. Exclusion is the keystone to all ruling class consumption experiences. And this has sort of hit the public just from the Wall Street Journal, which as an economist, I have to read every day. It's Rupert Murdoch's property like Fox News, but does very good business journalism. And the headline is, the ultra rich are spending a fortune to live in extreme privacy and moving in increasingly private spheres to avoid the indignities of public life. How perfectly put that is. Great, evil, ruling class journalism there. Very nice. Very descriptive, though. As we all know, whether you're, you know, a working class guy or a relatively prosperous professional, when you fly, it sucks. And when you have to go to the hospital, it sucks. You're in a mass consumption environment. You're in a crowded space. You're waiting in line. It's unpleasant. If you're wealthy, you know, you don't fly first class. You have a private jet. And you don't go to like the nice part of the hospital. There's private wings of special hospitals if you're wealthy to get away from everybody. And the great thing about markets is you can achieve this just naturally by charging more. You don't have to say this space is only for the wealthy, no poor. You just put a giant price on the one drinking fountain, and what do you know? It's naturally segregated. And so this is something I discuss a lot in Mastering the Universe, is just the phenomenon of class segregation, which has a lot of effects. For one thing, it means people only have so much knowledge of what's happening on the other side of these class divides. And you could say that that's true even within, you know, the broader middle class. Professionals live in suburbs, working class people live in, you know, more, you know, in the city environments and in apartments. Even there, there's a fair bit of segregation, although it's totally different from what you see with really wealthy people with multiple homes in, you know, maybe a large estate that's at the end of, you know, that's behind a gate at the end of a long road that just branches off the highway somewhere with no marking on that, you know. That segregation is a pretty real thing. And one thing it means is, you know, you don't know what's happening on the other side of the segregation wall. That's half the reason you build it, is because you don't want to know. And so it means people have fanciful ideas about what's happening on the other side. Economically, exclusion is the trend. I mean, it is something that is, you know, very explicitly and openly strived for by wealthy families and by all the firms that cater to them. Now, once you're in those exclusive wealthy environments, yeah, it is a totally different reality. I mean, you know, I'm lucky because I personally have a friend who, through a ridiculous series of events, married into one of these families, and I occasionally get to visit. But yeah, you're talking about estates and properties that just have this level of expensive grandeur That is very striking. And, you know, conspicuous consumption, originally developed by the Norwegian-American socialist Thorstein Veblen, is an extremely real thing. And it's not just that it's nice for you to walk around this top-story penthouse in a big city with very high ceilings and marble appointments and lots of guest rooms. It's very spacious. But also it's for showing off. And look at all the staff I have. They serve me, and it's for showing off to people. Like, the two go together very naturally. But it is amazing. We have very, very large mansions in this country. Again, going back to the Wall Street Journal, every Friday, the Wall Street Journal, if you're a print subscriber, which costs more than just reading it to a digital subscription online, if you're a print subscriber on Friday, the paper comes with a special separate section, mansion. And when you read the mansion section, it's just a mainly a profile and listing of very high-end real estate properties that will just melt your brain. The costs and the space and the absurd, wasteful, luxurious appointments of these places, you know. And especially because, of course, anyone who owns a $20 million mansion in LA or in the Hamptons owns others. Like, you'll have multiple huge homes. And that means, of course, that they're usually empty. Apart from your domestic staff, of course, they're usually empty. It's been well established. We have far more housing than we have homeless people in this country. Many of our unhoused population are former military service members, people struggling with drug addiction and mental illness. Countries like Finland have found if you house these people, they are far more able to get employment and go through treatment for their problems, for their Dick Cheney-caused war trauma or for their Sackler family-caused drug addictions. Much easier to cope with those things when you're not going back to the streets to sleep, you know. But here in America, we have all this housing stock, and it's just poker chips that belong to the ruling class. You buy them, you sell them. And the sky really is the limit on this stuff, because there's no limit to wealth. As I say in the book as well, if you want to be powerful, you know, you can become a senator, maybe you can become the president, and there are real powers that come with that, but they're constitutionally limited and they're time limited. Eventually you'll be out of office and there's things you can and can't do. If you're rich, there's no limit to the natural numbers. There's no limit to how much wealth and how many dollars you can accumulate. So the sky is the limit there. And so you have figures like Larry Ellison, who's becoming a major media kingpin in the United States and may or may not end up in charge of CNN itself. He's the guy who put Zionist hack Barry Weiss in charge of 60 Minutes and the rest of CBS. He bought Lanai, the Hawaiian island of Lanai, back in 2013 and turned it into a wealthy spa destination for his rich scumbag friends. But to me, and I always say this, to me, the real glimpse of what it's like to be in this very high-end echelon of household is to look at domestic staff. Because that's the thing. You look at these huge, you know, maybe on YouTube or on TV, you see videos about these huge mansions or really big fancy yachts, and you can imagine yourself in these places, and you may or may not make the connection that if you are on one of those properties, those are huge and expensive and require staff that are present all the time to clean and maintain and operate them. And that means you have domestic staff, you have employees who work for you, living in your home, doing things for you. And this may mean, you know, just simply having a fancy chef who cooks for you and one or two cleaning staff, but also means you have, often means you have a personal trainer. Very wealthy families will have a household manager who keeps the fridge stocked by sending out staff for food that you want when it's getting low. And they pay your bills. I always say when people are really rich, they don't pay their bills. They have a staff member who does the boring chore of paying your bills. And you have your personal trainer and your private chef and your household manager and other domestic staff. It's just a totally different reality where day by day in your own home or homes, you're in the presence of people who are your work subordinates, who you pay money to work for you in your home. I would just encourage everyone listening to just take some time today and think about what that can do to your mind. Everyone around you, you know, you may have your family members there or some real friends, but the people around you depend on you for their incomes. What happens, of course, is people lose touch with reality They're used to never being criticized. Everything they do, they get flattered for. And that's true of, your family and friends as well, because they want access to the cash as well. And that's why you get moments, I'll finish with this, like when during the, I guess it was the 2020 Democratic presidential debates, when Elizabeth Warren just humiliated Michael Bloomberg on stage. She starts criticizing him for trying to buy the nomination, and he really did spend $1 billion on that complete fizzle of a campaign. This Republican thinking he can buy the Democratic nomination and run against Trump. So you have two racist New York billionaires running against each other. At least it didn't come to that. But on stage, like Warren seriously criticizes him. I invite people to go on YouTube and just watch that little snippet of that debate. Michael Bloomberg looks like he's been hit in the face with a fish. Like he's just stunned. He just like sort of stammers and looks around. It's the look of a man who hasn't been criticized in 20 years and is used to telling everyone what to do. And suddenly he's on stage with some relatively feisty senator and getting criticized. And like his brain, like he's like a domesticated animal. He's lost the ability to cope with being criticized because it never happens because everyone he deals with depends on him for their economic prosperity. Like these are the real ramifications of this kind of lifestyle. You're segregated from the rest of the world. Who knows what goes on in it? No one ever makes you deal with anything unpleasant. And if you ever step outside that, you're just unable to cope with it completely because you've been living in this hermetically sealed privilege bubble for God knows how long.
Well, what's the implications then of that when the very rich also own most of the media in the US? You just mentioned Larry Ellison earlier, Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox News and the Wall Street Journal. How does that ownership shape how the media covers these questions of wealth and power?
Of course, as any self-respecting leftist or, fan of Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's propaganda model should know, it's hugely influential. Whether media are owned directly by some billionaire, like with the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or Fox News or Bloomberg or Twitter, or whether they're owned by some corporation like CNN, which has been part of various corporate conglomerates over the last couple of decades that are indirectly owned by the rich, of course, through their stock. Either way, what it means is the media have very strong class interests. Of course, they're corporate property, which means they're indirectly the property of the ruling class, means they're not going to be hiring journalists, and especially editors and producers who kind of decide what journalists will get hired and what they'll be able to cover and what they'll be able to say about things. It gives them a strong economic incentive to not criticize the hand that feeds them. And if you look at the Washington Post, a paper which, was nothing really to write home about before, but before and after its acquisition by Bezos, like the change is significant. And all the editorials now are some fairly abject bootlicking of the ruling class and encouraging people to, accept their economic lot. Prices aren't that high. It's reasonable to borrow money to go to college. Just horrible advice. It's what you should realize when you listen to commercial media, corporate or billionaire-owned media, when you're listening to commercial media, it's the ruling class speaking to you through pundits that were hired by producers that they hired. But it's the ruling class speaking to you, and it's what they would wish for you to hear. And I think when it comes down to the power of the ruling class, frankly, I think the clearest way to see it is just to recognize that if you're very rich, if you're Jeff Bezos, you can buy the Washington Post, a great historic paper, the Watergate breaking newspaper. He bought it for a couple percent of his net worth at the time of the purchase, and it's a much smaller percent of his net wealth today, of course. That's significant for crumbs. If you're super wealthy, for crumbs, you can buy a media asset that shapes the information that reaches people. I'm sorry, if that's not a position of power, I don't know what is. And that's why entities like public media, or independent media, like I usually write for and appear in, are so important. But it means they're always at a market disadvantage because, of course, the main business model in this sector is advertising. And if your billionaire is willing to take some losses because you're their pet entity, then that's nice. But usually these guys, all the way up to and including Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, aren't happy just to have this incredibly powerful mouthpiece. They also do expect it to make money, even though historically it's kind of difficult for media to make money. It depends on your base and, like, you know, your reader or viewer base, that is, you know, your market, as we would say now. But it's usually an advertising-based model, and that creates further filters for the media product to go through, because not only are you not going to criticize your wealthy owner, whether that's a billionaire or a corporation, and their colleagues, but it means now you can't criticize really any big company, because those are your potential advertisers. Those are your customers. And they're probably not going to come by and buy ad space or ad time if your media product is criticizing them or covering them in a way that they don't care for, or covering their business partners in a way they don't care for. So all these things create really strong institutional and class biases that shape the media product. And it's fascinating. If you talk to right-wing people, like, there is no more bedrock view in the American right wing than that media are liberal. Like, if you poke the corpse of a conservative, the corpse will say, liberal media. It's like a reflex action. Like, if you tap them below the kneecap, it's just something that even their dead body will be able to say, the phrase liberal media. And usually that's based on, it's like a recognized fact that journalists, like college professors, are a lot more likely to vote Democrat than to vote Republican, which is a real thing. But of course, as the right always does, they're ignoring the issue of power here. Do journalists decide what CNN's going to cover in their news section tonight? No. Do professors decide what classes will be offered and what will be covered? Limited discretion there, but no. These people are hired by people who are directly hired themselves by the company or billionaire that owns the media property. And it means, you know, you might vote for the Democratic candidate, but we will decide what stories you're assigned to, how you will cover them. We will edit your copy and tweak it so they don't criticize this company or the Israeli occupation of Gaza or whatever else it is that our owner doesn't care for you sharing with the public. The big question right now is, who's going to own CNN? Will it be the conservative Ellison family, or will it be Netflix? And it'll be one of the two of these billionaires or corporations that owns it, and they will have their own desires to keep their advertisers happy and avoid criticizing their senior government sources and their big corporate advertisers. And that will continue to shape media products. If you ever turn on cable news, anytime I see it, I go, oh, that's right, this is the problem. When Americans occasionally tune into politics and, you know, world news because there's some crisis, like, you know, a financial crisis or a war has broken out or there's an election next week, they turn on CNN and cable news, which is just the most brain poisoning thing you can ever take into your mind. And in fact, I would actually make the case, not consuming any news is preferable to consuming commercial and especially cable or broadcast news, because it's so ludicrously lopsided and its class commitments so able to hide behind free market claims. We have lots of competitors. If you don't like us, go turn to another competing corporate media product that will give you the same version of the world. They are at the center of the wealthy's ability to maintain control of society. Their political power is a big deal, but it's that media asset that allows them to create a vision of the world around people day by day. I really do agree with figures like Chomsky that that is the keystone to this whole system. Like, that is the center of their ability to maintain the rule that makes them the ruling class.
So after the global financial crisis, you know, Occupy burst on the scene and framed the enemy in an enduring way as the 1% of the wealthy against the 99%. And then, you know, fast forward to the present, you have the amazing election of Sahram Mamdani in the city that has the largest concentration of billionaires in the world. Do you feel like, you know, seeing the sort of ebb and flow in recent decades of politics around inequality, that a backlash against the rich is brewing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is broadly the case. I mean, even a lot of conservative voters now believe that the country and the world are controlled by money. Everything's unaffordable. These guys have so much money. Something's gone wrong there. Often there is likely to blame, you know, political administrations for somehow creating this situation. But a lot of people, and especially people, of course, who are already liberal or on the left, and especially young people now, very much recognizing that so much of our global problems, from the environment to the affordability crisis, are caused more or less by having so much wealth and power locked up in this incredibly affluent ruling class. So I do think that is the case, but it's very difficult because, you know, it's not just being rich, you know, you're powerful. And so you can blunt movements like Occupy. You can use dirty tricks to keep Bernie Sanders from getting a national political nomination. You can pour scorn on figures like Zohran. And sometimes, you know, victories can be pulled out in spite of that. But it means, of course, the odds are always long against progressive or left-wing candidates because they're competing against figures, you know, like the billionaires who are so infuriated by Zohran's primary and then general election victories. They're very annoyed and they'll pour money into centrist Democrats like Cuomo or into, you know, other Republican candidates. And so it makes it very difficult for that backlash to be manifested in some way. But I absolutely do think you're seeing that. And if you look at the polling, such as it is, that's conducted in the United States, it's especially this younger generation that is just has its eyes much more open, I assume because they know they're looking at their future, to the power of the wealthy and the drastic environmental conditions that we're in. And they're far more open to left-wing solutions like, you know, democratic socialist political candidates and things like that. So I think there absolutely is a backlash. But I would just say this, like, you can't just have a political backlash. You have to have organization in civil society. You know, Zohran's going to have a hard time even getting free buses, let alone like a progressive tax structure in the city, like a wealth tax, unless there's a large labor and socialist movement of some type that's in the streets every week demanding this stuff. Like Zohran, since his primary victory, has been saying that he doesn't want figures like terrible centrist Democrat leadership figures, like, say, Hakeem Jeffries, who's completely useless conservative. He doesn't want him to be primaried. Zohran should say that because his job now is to bring in the resources that he needs to have some deliverables on his socialist campaign promises. That's fine that he says that. The rest of us should ignore that and primary Jeffries and have a large labor movement. Like, really, it's the labor movement that is the strength of any kind of left-wing political progress, you know. It's that ability to turn out workers and have them say, no, you can't have coffee today. No, this hospital's not running right now. No, we're not picking up the garbage this week. We can't get any pay out of this billionaire scumbag who, you know, runs the city in the case of Michael Bloomberg, or who runs the country in the case of Donald Trump, or who runs our company in the case of most of the private economy. You need big movements, and people have to participate in them in some way.
Rob Larson, thank you so much again.
It's always a lot of fun.
I've been speaking with Rob Larson, professor of economics at Tacoma Community College, author of Mastering the Universe, The Obscene Wealth of the Ruling Class, What They Do with Their Money, and Why You Should Hate Them Even More. His other books include Bit Tyrants and Capitalism Versus Freedom. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.